You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast entitled Multidisciplinary Best Practices and Side Effect Profiles for PARP Inhibitor Therapy for Advanced Ovarian Cancer. Given the efficacy and improvements in survival outcomes with PARP inhibitors as guideline-recommended maintenance therapy, physicians need to be familiar with treatment-related toxicities to provide proactive management and improve tolerability for patients who can benefit from these potentially long-term therapies. I'm Dr. Ritu Salani from University of California in Los Angeles, and I'm so pleased to be joined by my colleague and friend, Dr. Pratibha Binder from University of California in San Diego. Today, we'll be discussing best practices and adverse effect profiles for PARP inhibitor therapy in advanced ovarian cancer. Welcome, Dr. Binder.
Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here today.
So let's just jump right in and let's just talk about the approved treatment options in the maintenance setting for PARP inhibitor therapy in ovarian cancer.
Sure. Yeah. So PARP inhibitors are approved for frontline maintenance therapy after a complete or partial response to first-line platinum-based chemotherapy. Biomarker requirements is really depending on specific PARP inhibitors. Niraparib is approved for ovarian cancer patients regardless of biomarker, and that's the quote-unquote all-comers. Rucaparib is approved for all-comers as well in Europe, but is limited to patients with BRCA mutated status or homologous recombination deficient status for their ovarian cancer in the United States. Olaparib, on the other hand, is approved as monotherapy for patients with germline and somatic BRCA1 and 2 mutations, but is also approved in combination with bevacizumab for patients with homologous recombination deficient ovarian cancer. PARP inhibitors are actually also approved as maintenance therapy in the platinum-sensitive ovarian cancer recurrence setting after a complete or partial response to platinum-based chemotherapy, but those patients have to be PARP inhibitor naive. The biomarker requirement is again dependent on the specific PARP inhibitor. Recent ASCO guidelines that were updated in 2022 say that it's okay to use PARP inhibitors in the recurrent setting regardless of biomarker. However, they do say to use caution with specific PARP inhibitors that may have a potential progression-free benefit and weigh those benefits against potential decrements in overall survival.
Yeah, that's a great summary. And I think it's important to recognize that there probably is a lot of class effect. And these PARP inhibitors are probably very similar, but there are some discrepancies in how they're approved or what their label states. So it's important to just kind of be mindful of that, although, you know, a little bit of it's based on study design. And I think it's really important to recognize that there were withdrawals of the PARP inhibitors in the platinum-sensitive relapse or in the treatment setting in the relapse or recurrent setting. And so looking at those guidelines to remind ourselves of where it's appropriate and where it's safe is always important, but there may be a role for it in certain patients. So I want to kind of pivot a little bit and just think about adverse events. You know, one of the really interesting things about PARP inhibitors is we're improving survival for these patients, and we know that keeping them on these therapies can be really important. Can you describe to me some proactive strategies that you have to mitigate some of the toxicities associated with PARP inhibitors, and remind me what some of those toxicities may be?
Yeah, so, you know, I remember when they were originally in 2014, we were studying PARP inhibitors, 2018, first approved in the frontline maintenance therapy setting. And I remember being at some conference and they saying FAN, you know, FAN is the AE's acronym for PARP inhibitors, and that is fatigue, anemia, and neutropenia. So those are definitely the three most common AEs related to all PARP inhibitors, you know, as a class of drugs. But there are additional toxicities that are highly dependent on specific PARP inhibitors. For example, niraparib, it can be associated with thrombocytopenia. It can be associated with hypertension. Patients can complain of insomnia and anxiety. And then some patients have just told me, I don't feel myself. Rucaparib, on the other hand, has been associated with elevation in LFTs or transaminitis and is also associated with severe fatigue. On the other hand, olaparib has been associated with an elevation in creatinine that may not actually be related to renal failure or kidney injury, but on our laboratory examinations, we are seeing this elevation of creatinine as well as some increase in GI side effects like nausea and vomiting. So, you know, usually when I'm seeing these patients, I like to show them a table. I like to show them the list from the clinical trials, the AEs, and what percentage of patients have them. I like to engage and share decision-making to pick a PARP inhibitor if they are candidates for more than one. And I also sometimes, depending on patient, depending on their access to a phone, I sometimes have them even download the CTCAE app so that they, when they start to feel something, they're able to look at it and know, okay, this is okay, or this is highly worrisome. I should talk to my doctor about this. So I really like to make sure that we go over those OAEs so they have the expectation that they are going to feel different. This is oral therapy, but it is chemotherapy, and therefore are anticipating those side effects versus being completely surprised by them.
Yeah, that's great. And just to piggyback on something you said, you know, there are these different options. There are kind of different dosing. I know with niraparib, where you mentioned the thrombocytopenia and the hypertension, that there are some individualized starting dose recommendations. Would you mind reviewing that just briefly for me?
Yes. So, you know, when the original approval went out at that time, the starting dose for niraparib was 300 milligrams daily. So it was a once daily dosing. Although a lot of our patients with ovarian cancer, they're coming off, there are six or more cycles of chemotherapy. They might have a low platelet to begin with. So there was a individualized dosing that was 200 milligrams for patients with platelet counts less than 150,000 or weight less than 77 kilograms. So, you know, after that individualized dosing came out, I think pretty much everybody standardized their treatment to, if they were giving niraparib, they would start at 200 because the 300 dose had a really high high percentage of AEs and discontinue rate or even interruption rates.
Yeah. And so I definitely follow, we call it kind of affectionately weights and plates as kind of a guideline of where to start. And I definitely use a lower dose for those patients who meet that criteria and hopefully mitigate some of the side effects. I think one of the other things is because the thrombocytopenia and niraparib, we do have a little bit of different lab monitoring when compared to the other PARP inhibitors. Would you briefly review what the lab monitoring guidelines are for both niraparib and then also for olaparib and rucaparib?
Yeah, so niraparib actually, because of that potential of acute, you know, hematologic toxicities, I usually want to get a set of labs before they actually start treatment. And then usually I will watch their CBC or watch their labs every week for 4 weeks before I switch them over to a 4 week interval for labs. With olaparib and rucaparib, I usually with those patients will do labs every 2 weeks while they're starting their PARP inhibitor. So occasionally, if I've had patients that have required interventions while they were on their six cycles of chemo, where they needed a transfusion or they needed G-CSF factor or even dose delays because of thrombocytopenia, I might be a little bit more conservative with those patients and actually check labs every week while they're starting for the first month, or even start them on a first dose reduction if they have residual hematologic toxicities from their chemotherapy.
And one of the really cool things the studies did is they allowed a little bit of a time leeway of when to start the PARP inhibitors after completion of primary chemotherapy. And so they allow up to 12 weeks. And so I'll take advantage of that depending on patient's symptoms. And, you know, some patients tolerate chemotherapy, you know, remarkably well and can start sooner. I usually almost always wait at least a month though, but some patients need a little bit more time. And one of the side effects I continually struggle with is fatigue. Do you have any tips on management of fatigue for these patients?
Yeah. So, you know, fatigue, that's a hard one. And again, with the hematologic toxicities, there has been data that shows that the patients that actually have, you know, BRCA mutations may have higher rates of toxicities. And also I've noticed with fatigue as well. So, you know, with fatigue, you know, I usually have the patient kind of develop a routine before they start and while they're on it, where they're getting some sort of exercise daily. If they need naps in the afternoon, they take that as needed and then have a scheduled bedtime. I also, again, because I like them to have those CTCAE guidelines, I have them kind of document what their fatigue is like. And if they are either grade 3 or persistently grade 2 with just super bothersome quality of life diminishing side effects, then I will hold the PARP inhibitor for those patients. And then depending on the grade, either restart with a dose reduction or try to restart with different strategies. I also, you know, because these patients are going to be on these drugs for a longer period of time, I've started using more low dose Ritalin for my patients that either are doing great and no other side effects except for fatigue and therefore don't want to dose reduce. So I'll usually prescribe them Ritalin 2.5 milligrams milligrams daily to kind of help with their fatigue. And they do say they see a benefit and are able to get through the things they need to do in a day.
And I think it's also important to remember that many of these patients who experience fatigue, it actually may get better over time. So kind of helping understand dose reductions or interruptions as indicated, but kind of also encouraging them that this is sometimes a worse at the beginning and kind of self-corrects, if you will, and then to rule out any other sources of fatigue. So I always like to check, you know, thyroid function. I'll check for anemia, which is obviously part of the standard lab monitoring. And then you mentioned sleep hygiene, which I think can also be really helpful for some patients. And then before we move on, I just want to kind of lastly touch upon some of the GI toxicities. Oftentimes, ovarian cancer can present with a lot of GI symptoms, and so this can sometimes be a challenge for patients. Do you have any tips on managing maybe nausea or some other GI side effects from PARP inhibitors?
Yeah. So, you know, again, when I prescribe these, the patients will definitely, before they start their PARP inhibitor, get supportive therapy. So we'll usually go through, you know, usual antiemetics, go through Compazine, Ondansetron, Phenergan, what worked for them during chemotherapy, and therefore we'll continue those drugs while on PARP inhibitor. Occasionally, I have prescribed, especially when people are traveling or when they're having more of a difficult time, a short course of low-dose steroids or a short course of Ativan, and then sometimes even a scopolamine patch when they're doing other things or traveling. But, you know, despite all those things, if it is persistent, and again, they're just either struggling to keep weight on, struggling to eat, then I will have the patients again hold therapy. So I feel like the dose stopping is very important before doing the dose reduction. So we have them actually stop the medication for 7 days, let that medication clear out of their system before starting with a dose reduction. And again, the reductions are different depending on PARP inhibitor. With niraparib, again, I also start with 200 all the time. So we have one dose reduction from 200 daily to 100 daily. With rucaparib, there's three dose reductions with the starting dose of 600 twice a day, down to 500 twice a day, down to 400 twice a day, and then down to 300 twice a day. And then with olaparib, we can go from 300 milligram twice a day down to 200 twice a day, down to 150 twice a day. So.
Yeah. And just to clarify, I actually start with niraparib 300 milligrams for those patients who meet the appropriate criteria. So I have two dose reductions in that group, but I know there's different variances in practices. You know, one of the side effects that's always very concerning, even though it's rare, is AML or acute myeloid leukemia or myelodysplastic syndromes. Can you tell me kind of what the rates are with PARP inhibitor use and kind of how you monitor these patients for it?
Yeah. So in the clinical trials, the rate of AML was about 1 to 2% in the trials in the frontline maintenance PARP inhibitor therapy. It was slightly higher when we looked at the clinical trials that were using PARP inhibitors in the recurrent setting, whether it was recurrent maintenance setting or, like you had said, prior to withdrawals of certain approvals, you know, PARP inhibitors were used as treatment in patients with platinum sensitive or platinum resistant ovarian cancer. So those trials, the rate of AML was actually higher, 3 to 4%, but the patients who were receiving placebo also had some rate of AML because, again, these patients have been so heavily pretreated with different regimens of chemotherapy. I actually, luckily myself, have not had a patient develop AML or MDS while I have been prescribing PARP inhibitor therapy or after they were done with the PARP inhibitor therapy. I have had patients that had other bone marrow suppression issues, but not AML. And I've also seen patients that were referred to me because they developed AML and had ovarian cancer. Most of those patients that I saw, though, they did tend to be treated a little off guidelines. So there was one patient who had PARP inhibitor therapy for more than 3 years. One of the other patients had seen PARP inhibitor therapy in multiple settings in the maintenance setting and then also treated again in the recurrent setting after multiple lines of chemo. And then again, one of the patients had a history of pediatric tumor that was treated with radiation. So they had received spine radiation and chest radiation before and then had received, again, all the chemotherapy and PARP inhibitors. So again, you know, I've seen it definitely higher, most commonly with patients where we're not actually following these guidelines to keep that rate lower. And again, once I'm done with PARP inhibitor therapy, they've completed their therapy, haven't had recurrence, I actually continue to watch labs for these patients, typically every 3 months, along with their surveillance on CA125. I'll also do a CBC. So I'm watching their hematologic toxicity possibility even after they finish PARP inhibitor therapy.
Yeah, and I think you hit on a key point. Like, you know, it's not a common thing, but when you see it can be quite devastating. And so partnering with hematologists, having a high acuity for lab abnormalities, especially if somebody has persistent anemia despite dose reductions, dose holding, or kind of multiple parameters on their CBC that are abnormal. And then getting a hematologist to help manage that, whether it's bone marrow biopsy or additional testing, can be really critical to help kind of maybe stop before something becomes from myelodysplastic to AML or intervene sooner.
And holding, if you have any suspicion for any of these, basically holding drug that whole time while you're doing the workup.
Absolutely. So key to evaluate it thoroughly and make sure that you have clear the patient from that and ensuring that they're in a safe place. And this actually kind of piggybacks right perfectly into my next question for you is, you know, we talked about consulting with a hematologist. Multidisciplinary care is so important in all of our patient management. And I think when we have drugs that are, you know, associated with different adverse events or can have those, how do you manage, what are your best practice guidelines for multidisciplinary care for patients?
Yeah. You know, I definitely don't shy away from phoning a friend. Luckily, I'm at a place where I have a lot of friends. You know, we talked a little bit about AML for patients. So I had a patient who just had persistent thrombocytopenia in subsequent chemotherapies after she had finished her PARP inhibitor maintenance therapy without a recurrence. But subsequently during chemotherapy, really the only problem was low platelets. So again, I had this patient also see a hematologist. She also underwent bone marrow biopsy once there was confirmation that this is not looking like MDS or AML. She actually got started on L-trombopag. And ever since then, her platelets have been great. I'm having hematology manage that because it's not a medication that I have prescribed or usually prescribe. Other things that I also, you know, phone a friend a lot is, again, our patients tend to be 60, 70 plus. A lot of them will have multiple other medical conditions, including chronic kidney disease. So when I've had patients that have been on olaparib and I see their creatinine rising, sometimes if it goes to a level where I'm not comfortable, I'll pause to see if that improves. If we see an improvement, but not back to baseline, then I will send those patients to nephrology as well for a complete workup to make sure that there's not something else that I am missing, and also let them know, hey, I can switch them to a different PARP inhibitor if you think that this is due to PARP inhibitor use. And then obviously, I love our palliative care group. A lot of the patients do already have issues with fatigue. They also have issues with sleep hygiene and insomnia and mood. So typically when I have patients that are going to be on a long-term therapy, I like to involve our palliative care team as well.
Yeah, and I think you hit the key point. You never have to worry alone. We have lots of colleagues in different specialties who can always help us with management of these patients. Well, I want to thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. And I want to thank Dr. Binder for sharing her insights and experiences with us regarding the proactive management strategies and the multidisciplinary approach to improving quality of life for patients undergoing maintenance therapy for advanced ovarian cancer. And thank you for joining us. We hope you will listen to the second episode of this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group, who in support of improving patient care is jointly accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education, the Accreditation Council for Pharmacy Education, and the American Nurses Credentialing Center to provide continuing education for the healthcare team. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. A special thanks to our supporters, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals and Merck & Company, Incorporated, who provided educational grants for this activity.